All right. Well done. Well done. Most of you could have carried on for a while, which is...
just been married 14 months, so...
No problem, Shad.
No, I didn't say no problem, but it's just 14 months ago.
Okay. Okay.
Not 14 years.
True. We'd love to see you again in 14 years. Yeah.
Yes.
Problems? What problems? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, your problem's not with your wife, just with a visiting speaker.
No, I think you're doing great.
Okay. Maybe you can talk to him over break time. Huh? Okay, we have an hour together before tea to talk about the conflict section, courtship, centerpiece, conflict, 5-2 to 6-13, then the final concert in which they go on playing a new score together, and they make beautiful music following the conductor and the same score. And it's getting beyond the conflict into a new stage, an altogether new stage of the relationship in 7-8. But to get to 7-8, they have to, most of us have to go through 5-6. You have to go through 5-6 to get to 7-8. And conflict is not an enemy, it's an ally, I think. It's not an enemy, it's an ally. And I like all of us, including Kathy and I, it took us a long time to get here, but to welcome conflict. It's the exact reverse of a girl at UCLA where I was a staff worker for 6 years, some years ago. And a girl came to me, had a very nice young man that she was committed to, engaged. And she said, "No, we're not getting married for another 6 months." And she said, I can't wait until we're married and off on the honeymoon and setting up an apartment together so I can finally be myself. I can't wait to get married so I can finally be myself." See, she was giving him the guy that, the girl that she thought he wanted, living up to all the expectations, creating an unreal, high-stress, ideal wife. And then after the I do's were said, he'd find out what he had really said I do to. So, exact the reverse. Because marriage is, my definition, by the way, is a lifelong commitment between two sinners. That's marriage. It's a lifelong commitment between two sinners. So sin will surface and it will appear. It'll come up in all kinds of ways. And sin comes up in Kathy in some ways and me in other ways. But for us to submerge that, subdue it, and not make a fuss, but to let each other know that, hey, I feel strongly about this, that alerts me that, hey, here's a side of my wife that I didn't know. And for something that might be small potatoes to her, but I create a fuss and I make an argument and I will not let this thing go, instead of saying, "What a stubborn guy. I didn't know what I was in for when I said I do," March 31, 1973. But instead ask the more helpful question, "Why does he feel so strongly about this?" Because every area of conflict is an open door to getting to know your partner better. Why does he feel so strongly? Why does this turn her off so badly? Different ways of money. No, she's a saver, he's a spender. And they can't get their act together until he begins to visit her family for a while, sees the family's attitudes toward money, their spending patterns, and all of a sudden the penny drops. No, this is where she was raised. These are the values that surrounded her, invaded her for 23 years. And after 23 months, I'm getting bent out of shape. I need to understand this family that I've married into. See, and today, more than the day, the year that we got married, I realized that I've married the Sankey clan and that Kathy came with a package. And the package that she came from informs a whole lot of who she is that I need to get to know. And I had my mother-in-law problems. The most ugly, crummy part of our relationship was engagement. Engagement, we were engaged for nine months, and Kathy's mom and I played wishbone. And I had one side of the wishbone, her mother had the other side. And I said, well, the leaving should begin when the ring is on the finger. And her mother said, no way, she's mine until she's married. Until she says, I do, she's my daughter. And I said, well, we're beginning to explore what my wife means. And so were we into the wishbone, major conflict, that for the first time in her life and the only time in our relationship, she broke out in acne. And there was one stage in the engagement, I said, let's just call it quits, it's not worth it. And we were apart for a week or two. Then you couldn't stand it and you called her. Something. Revisionist! So something happened, hey? But yeah. But the acne was really serious, and you know, Kathy was the wishbone from her mom and I. But I had realized, hey, I'm, in a sense, I'm getting married to the package here, and mom-in-law is part of the package. And the dairy farm community and six siblings, I grew up with a sister, and all of that informs 35 years of our walk together. So why does she feel so strongly? Why does he react that way? Conflict opens up different doors to rooms in your marriage home that you've not yet explored. No, there's an attic that you didn't even know was there. The basement has a secret passageway that you suspected, but now you know. Tread lightly here. So conflict is a wonderful, welcoming thing to grow a relationship deeper and stronger if you handle it well. So her indifference, I'll talk about that. Her initiative and their involvement, Kathy, and then his ingenuity. And we'll notice some, I think, some fascinating stuff in chapter 6 about his role in getting the relationship patched up again. The way he handles this, you know, this is marital craft at its best. This guy's my hero. He's on my pedestal. But before it all went wrong for Solomon, he knew how to build and develop a relationship. He is really, really good. So that's where we're going. This is me. This is the wife. This is me. 5:2-8. I slept. This is the second dream sequence of the book. 3:1-5. 3:1-5 is dream sequence number one. The only place, other place where the watchmen are mentioned, the watchmen are very friendly when she does the right thing. Now the same watchmen appear and they're not friendly at all. That should give you a clue. There's two dreams, two sets of watchmen. I slept and my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. I've taken off my robe. She says, must I put it on again? I wash my feet. Must I soil them again? My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I arose to open for my lover, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my cloak. See, dressed in what they thought was prostitutes' clothing. They took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls. Oh, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my lover, what will you tell him? Tell him I am faint with love. Tell him I am faint with love. So, 5:2-8, which we call her indifference. I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, listen. My lover's knocking, and as he says, my head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. My reconstruction is, by the way, that again, it's matters of state. There's an empire to run. He attends meetings. The meetings go late, like board meetings at many, many churches, be it Snowden Baptist or Rosemont Bible. Board meetings can go on and on and on until 10, 11, serious ones, 12, 15, 1:30 in the morning. And important stuff. And the guy always, whose spiritual gift is to make a long story longer. He's in full flight, just monkeying around with minutiae, with small things. And you think, God, is there a godly way to tell him to shut up? How do I do this? And what also happens if you're a normal board member, is you say, my body is at this table, but I'd like to be home in bed with my wife. I'd like to be at home in bed. And your mind starts wandering and fantasizing a bit. It's okay to fantasize about your wife. Perfectly okay. And that's what happens at some late government or board meetings. And probably that's what happened to him. It's my reading. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. He's come to her place in the palace very, very late. It is very late. But he's been thinking about her all this time. He's got all this love language, fourfold, boom, 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 boom. He's got all of this prepared, plus a little love gift that he leaves on the ledge inside her door. He's got all this prepared, fourfold love and the little love gift. But he comes and he's expecting a little attention, no doubt a little sexual attention. That's what you really need after a heavy, especially unproductive board meeting. That's what you want to go home and just forget this stuff. Get this stuff off the agenda. Go home to my wife. Yes. So I'm guessing that's Solomon, hey? Listen. Listen, my lover is knocking and credit the king. Open to me. Some sexual attention, I have no doubt. Open to me. And then my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one, credit the king that the one whammy that he could have pulled on her is to say the one word that would have almost demanded a response, at least in the 10th century. My sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one, my bride. I'm the bridegroom, you're the bride, I have my rights. I say I jump, you say how high. That's the way things work in the kingdom. You are the bride. Very interesting. The Hebrew, no doubt in my mind at all, constructs things this way. He had mentioned bride in chapter 4 six times. Six times. If he had mentioned it seven times, we would say this is a perfect marriage. It's not. Seven times would say a perfect marriage. Seven. But he stops short of perfection, the same place that most of our relationships are at. That's why the book connects. They have a conflict. They do not live happily ever after. God says, eat, O friends, and drink your fill. The next verse, they're at each other's throats. What's going on? This is normal, everyday, 21st century marriage. They know all about it 3,000 years ago. He doesn't say, my bride, and say, hey, I have my rights. You may have been at 7 o'clock, ready with a meal, put it in the microwave. At 9 o'clock, hoping I'd come home. At 11, 12, you're still not there. Of course you're upset, but hey, have you been at a board meeting recently? So I have my rights, but he doesn't say that. My sister, my darling, and so on, he does not pull that whammy. My head is drenched with dew. Her response, let me read it two more ways to get that power of the third verse. I read it normally the first time. There's better ways to read it. I've taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again? That gets more at the flavor, the intent of the third verse. But when I read it the third way, you'll see what's going on. You'll get it like that. It's only one verse. I have taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I have washed my feet. Must I soil them again? Six times in one verse. She has serious eye trouble. Six times in one verse. It's all about me. It's all about me. I. And we say, well, it's such a small thing. Hey, a discarded robe, dirty feet, discarded robes, dirty feet. It is so small. But if you stop to think, in comparison to a ton of motor vehicles sitting in your drive, the keys that were supposed to be on the dresser, very small bunch of keys, and you say to your wife, honey, what'd you do with the keys? And she says, you had them last, is part of usually the start of a very interesting discussion. What'd you do with the keys? You saw them last. Discussion. Keys are a very small thing. So is... what's his name? Antonio Vivaldi, The Four Seasons. I love it. A friend recorded that for me. But into fall, about 23 minutes into fall, there's a little skip in the recording. Like that. A little skip. And every time that I played that since then, At about 20 minutes, 21, 22 minutes, I was anticipating that skip. No, in winter, the other seasons were fine, but after two or three times of listening to the little skip on all four seasons, I tossed it, I threw it away. The little skip spoiled it. It's a small thing. So is your tooth. And when you've got a bad toothache, you don't say, thank God my heart is ticking, my knees are in good shape, the pancreas seems to be working, doing what it's supposed to be doing, I'm seeing, hearing well. All you think, if I don't see a doctor or a dentist tomorrow, I will die. See, it's a small thing. This is a small thing, but it's indifference. And the emotional scale is not hate and love and indifference, but it's hate and love, very close, and indifference. It's hate and love that are very close. Both of these are intense, feeling, upfront emotions. Over here is what Kathy and I call the part of your body that signals the beginning of the end of the marriage is not this, or even this, but it's this. The beginning of the end of your marriage starts with the shoulders. Who cares? Stay out as late as you want. Who are you with? What you are doing? For how long? It's up to you. Twin lives, twin beds, twin budgets, eventually twin roofs. Who cares? Or the 21st version of who cares? You'll hear it on the voices of your teens and even your 10 and 8-year-old. Whatever. Exactly. You know it. Well, watch for it. Whatever can kill your marriage. Whatever can kill your marriage. And it's the little things, the little things. See, I argue that the big A, the three A's, that scripture I think allows for a marriage to dissolve and to end, the three big A's are right up here, adultery, abuse, and addiction. They don't start with adultery, abuse, and addiction. No, they start with an unresolved issue, like her making toast in the morning the way he doesn't like it. No, he likes it hard British style, stacked up like this, instead of soft and stacked so it remains soft. In Britain, you do the toast this way, not this way. Mm-hmm. And you have marmalade with the toast and an egg that is cooked for maybe 30 seconds. And the husband says, you know, I grew up in Wales. This is how I like my breakfast. He gently reminds her 2, 3, 15 times, and still comes, you know, the toast. And the peanut butter is there. She doesn't listen to me. See, that's when his eyes start wandering and his feet follow the eyes, and that's where they end up. Never starts with adultery. Never starts with abuse. Never starts with addiction, the big three. But it starts with discarded robes and dirty feet. That's where it starts. My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I arose to open for my lover. Too late. Too late. And my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh. Here's the lock, you see. She has her own room. Here's the ledge. There's a ledge on the outside, the inside. And he takes a little pouch, which when you touch the pouch, it can spill and dissolve a fragrant myrrh or another perfume. He slides it in there. Don't say, I'm sorry about being so late. Maybe this will brighten your morning, but I'm leaving. I'm giving you space and time to reflect on what's happened. I'm just removing myself, giving some space here. He leaves this little love note, this little, my heart sank. I opened for my lover. My heart sank at his departure. And here's the key, 5-6. Did you see it? I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The two signs that your marriage is in serious trouble. And the first is distance. I looked for him, but did not find him. And silence. I called him, but he did not answer. If those two things are true of your relationship, it's in need of some serious repair. And the clues are right there in Scripture, right in the text. Distance and silence. And all of you, if you've been married for 10 years or 14 months, somebody else came to me and said, you've been married for about a year. Isn't that the couple? Yeah, you guys, hey? For a year. You probably have already had the chance, maybe not yet, you've already had the chance that you can be sitting about 1.6 feet away from each other across a lasagna or even in coffee and a croissant. And even though the bodies are 1.5 feet away, your spirits, your hearts, are about 1 million miles apart. There's distance, even though you're physically very close, there's the distance. And if there's three languages, you see, there's a language of affection, information, and persuasion. There's three languages all of us use, affection and information and persuasion. When things go wrong, distance and silence, you retreat into information and persuasion. Information, your mother called earlier today. You might want to give her a call. Persuasion, would you pick up the kids on the way home from daycare tomorrow? Life has to go on. But affection is reserved for the very young and the very old, and it gets lost in the middle. So I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The clues are there in the Song of Solomon. And the watchman found me. This is not a surprise either. If your marriage is wrong, you'll find that when you step out the door in the morning, the rest of your world is wrong too. It affects the rest of your life. And eventually your boss will know, I'm not getting full production from this guy. Things must be wrong at home. Your marriage will spill out in places where you can't grab a hold of it and control it. So the watchmen who were so friendly in 3 are now beating her up in 5. Oh, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, I need some help. I need some help. I've got to get out of this. I caused the problem. How can we solve this? And she pulls in some support team for help. And how that all works is what Kathy's going to help us with.
I want to give you a handout on conflict, just to give you a little feel about how conflict happens with us. We all have a conflict style. I don't know if you've studied this before or not, but we all have a conflict style, and basically we have a preference when conflict happens as to what we want to do. And we might, you know, go to one first and then to another one. But in your marriage, you will probably find that you don't have the same style. You may, but usually you'll have more than one. So if you look at this sheet in front of you, you'll see there are lines on each side. There's a relationship line that goes up, and then there's the goal lines. And in every relationship, this is what's being balanced out. It's how important is the relationship at this point? And how important it is that I have my goals met at this point. And in a relationship, often one person will be more people-oriented and the other more goal-oriented or task-oriented. Now, traditionally, that might be the male is the more goal-oriented and the woman is the more relational-oriented. But it's not always like that. Sometimes it can be the opposite, depending on the personality. So we have these lovely animals to kind of help us to understand. Now on yours you have the eagle at the top, don't you? Top right. Originally, the one at the top was an owl, where you see problem solving. It was originally an owl. So when we were in Africa, we were teaching this, only to discover that an owl is a symbol of very bad luck and evil spirits. So we thought, maybe that's not what we want for problem solving. So, but an eagle, you see, in Africans will know that an eagle soars above its problems. Particularly the Zambian flag has the fish eagle, and that's the symbol. Zambia will arise above its problems. So we figured eagles may be better for that culture than the owl. But in our culture, of course, an owl in North American, Western culture, an owl is a wise bird that does a lot of looking and taking things in before speaking. So I don't know. It would be interesting to know in Chinese culture what. Not good. Owl's not good either. Well, interesting. We're the exceptions then. So anyway, to get back to this, what you have is basically with the relationship, that one is like, how cooperative am I as a person? You know, so if you're high up on it, then you're a very cooperative person. If you're low on that list, if it's of low importance, it means basically you're satisfying more yourself than the other person. And then with goals, it's how assertive am I? So if you're at the far end, at the shark end, then you're a very assertive person. And if you're at the other end, you're not assertive, you'll just let things be. So in this story, she is being... what? Can you guess what she is? What our lady in the story is? Can you guess? I think so. I think she's probably more withdrawing than anything else, because basically she's not worried about her relationship with her husband at that point, and she's not assertive to get anything. She's just staying in her own little spot. And there are times when all of these styles are appropriate. For instance, if I'm walking down the street and somebody comes at me with a gun and says, I want your money, then I am going to be a turtle. I'm going to say, take the money. You know, there are times when that's appropriate. And I don't want to take too much time on it, but say if you're buying a car and you know you only have $12,000 to spend on a car, and you meet a salesman and he says, I know that's the car you want, but I'm sorry, it's actually $17,000. You're going to say, $12,000 or else, I'm leaving. So the salesman will then have to decide, can he come down $5,000 for you, or you know, will he let you walk away? There are cases when you have to say, I'm sorry, I don't. That's all I have. If it's not good enough, then I walk away from it. But obviously in marriage, we avoid these extremes if we can. But you might see yourself, maybe you're the one who lets things ride, you smooth over things, and thinking, I don't want to make a fuss, I'll give up my goals because I don't want to make a fuss right now. What's important to me, I will give up because I don't want to cause problems, I don't want to cause conflict, not realizing that the conflict is already there. You know, or you may be the kind of person who says, no, this is going to be done now, and you're going to do it. We're going to do it, whether you like it or not, we're going to do it. And, of course, that would be more your forcing style of communication. And you have compromising, the fox in the middle or the eagle at the top. Compromising is those little things. They're not monumental issues in the marriage. You have one car. You have two places to go on Saturday. He has to be one place, she has to be the other place. So you might say, you know, I know your men's meeting is only once a month, so why don't you take the car today, and then next week when I have my girl time with my friends at the coffee shop, I would like the car next week. So it's a give and take instead of you saying, hey, I need the car, I want to do some shopping this morning, and you're not going to your men's meeting because that's, you know, it's more that's like a short term. But what about a long term thing? You know, you have a job offer in Vancouver, you know, but of course it will mean taking all the children out of school, and the teenagers aren't very happy about it. You know, you're the wife, you've got your friends for 20 years and you have to leave all of them. And I love Rosemount. How could I possibly leave Rosemount? And so that is what you would call a long-term decision. You know, you're going to talk through the pros and cons. You're going to work together to say, hey, this has got to be best for all of us. And it may be risky for some of us, but we're going to work through, we're going to take the time to make the right decision. So you have to kind of decide what's the level of importance of the decision. But it gives you an idea of the conflict, right? You can how do you resolve these things? And you know yourself, probably, or you can ask your spouse, what kind of person do you think I am? Am I a shark? Am I a teddy bear? Am I a turtle? You know, and you can just talk through that because there's a lot of growing that comes. So in this case, she's being a bit of a turtle, just kind of saying, you know, do I have to take off my robe? Do I have to wash my feet again? But then she realizes that she's made a very, very big mistake and that time with him is actually precious. And it's interesting because then we come to verse, as Hank was quoting, 5 verse 8, O daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my lover, what will you tell him? She has a group of friends that she can trust with an issue like this. See, this is a conflict that she is unable to solve on her own. She feels like, I don't know how to handle this. I don't know how to make this right. And she has some people that she goes to. I would hope that each of you has, either as a single person or as a couple together, that you have, quote, daughters of Jerusalem that you can go to. Because every marriage is going to face a situation, even after 35 years, where you say, I don't know, we don't know how to get past this one. Can you help us? And I remember some years ago, I think we had maybe 2 children, and Hank and I were having a conflict, and I don't know even what the details of it were. But I felt in this position, I thought, I am the wife of a Christian worker here in this town. Now, who am I supposed to go to because I'm having trouble in my marriage? Who do I go to? And I had a friend who was my prayer partner, but I was thinking, yeah, but if I tell her, then she's not going to like Hank. You know, she's going to be prejudiced against Hank, and I don't want that to happen. But then as I thought about it more, I felt like the Holy Spirit saying, no, go to Jane. Because what I discovered was that not only was she someone who kept confidentiality, but she actually cared about my husband and she cared about my marriage. Like she cared about the two of us. Like Hank was saying, she was someone who wanted to help us fight for our marriage. When I was working at Concordia, I was a teacher assistant, and I would often hear the young wives talking about their husbands or the girls talking about their boyfriends. Well, he is this and that, and, you know, I can't believe he does that and that. And they'd be, you know, criticizing the man that they loved to all their friends. And the friends would say, well, why don't you dump him? You know, it was just so easily solved. You know, just dump him. And I remember just being shocked at the attitude. And that is not the kind of person. You're not looking for someone who's going to try and destroy your relationship or who's going to take your side against your spouse. They might see your point of view, but their goal is to bring you back together. So look for the daughters of Jerusalem in your lives. And then it's like, okay, what kind of advice do they give? Well, I would, if I were a daughter of Jerusalem, I would say, well, Shulamite woman, what you need to do is this, 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 and this. This will solve your problem. But that's not what she does, what they do. Look at the form, 5 verse 9. They actually ask a question. I mean, how clever is that? They say, how is your beloved better than others, most beautiful of women? How is your beloved better than others that you charge us so? In other words, they're saying, you know, who is this guy that, you know, you're asking us? And in the asking the question, you see, they must have an instinct of what's wrong, that she's shown indifference towards her husband, because they're saying, okay, remember, what is it about this guy that made you choose him? And so they're trying to get her now to reflect positively about him, because one of the biggest barriers to resolving a conflict is my staying in my place with my attitude and what has been done to me, instead of trying to work for something good. And we've seen it in marriages, but we've seen it in the church, you know, where you get people polarized. And what happens when people get polarized? They no longer appreciate the goodness in the other person. And once your heart is that hard, it becomes almost impossible to resolve conflict. And so what they're working on is softening her heart and helping her to reflect, to begin to appreciate him again. So she does. She begins to say, she says in verse 10, my lover is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. He's the best of 10,000. And then she gives some details, and she finishes in verse 16, and she says, his mouth is sweetness itself. He is altogether lovely. So she begins hers. Again, the book ends, we like to say. She says, he's outstanding among 10,000, and he's altogether lovely. Does this sound familiar? Do you remember the wedding night? All beautiful you are, my darling, there's no flaw. She now has the chance to respond and to give the same sort of speech back and to appreciate him in the way that he appreciated her on the wedding night. And that gift of appreciation just breaks down all these barriers that have this silence, this distance between them. And she does the Hebrew thing, which is to take physical things to describe spiritual or emotional qualities in him. So she begins and she says in verse 11, his head is pure as gold, his hair is wavy and black as a raven. Of course, her hair was wavy like a flock of goats, but his is wavy and black as a raven. But the point there, the beginning, his head is pure as gold. What is she saying? He has a gold head? No, she's describing the quality of gold. Isn't it something that's been refined? It's goodly. A mind that is gold is, you know, we often say that his thoughts are like gold. There's wisdom. Of course, he's Solomon. We're not surprised. You know, but there she says it. She starts at the top of his body and says his head is pure as gold. And then she goes down. There's the eyes again. She responds back. His eyes are like doves, and she elaborates, by the water streams washed in milk, you imagine the white of the eye, mounted like jewels. You know how we sometimes can just draw an eye from the side, and it looks a little bit like a jewel, like a diamond that's mounted? So she elaborates the picture. It says, cheeks are like beds of spice yielding perfume. How does she know that? She's remembering what it is like to be close to those cheeks that smell like perfume. His lips are like lilies dripping with myrrh. Yes, he kisses well, but he also, the words that come off those lips are myrrh. They're precious. They're wonderful words. Arms are rods of gold. So what is it about gold? There's a purity, but it's like they're arms of strength, but they're used for good things. These are not arms, and I always say this in Africa because it's a culture that beats. If you don't like your wife, you beat her. It's a sign of that you love her, that you beat her if she's done something wrong. These are arms that are good. They're of gold, and they embrace her. They hug her. That's what she knows. They protect her. His body is like polished ivory decorated with sapphires. Now, the only one who would know that his body is like polished ivory is the wife who's seen the body without clothes. And so she's also describing this beautiful ivory trunk of his body and just what a gorgeous man he is. And I hope you wives take the time to tell your husbands how beautiful they are. Doesn't matter how old they are, they still have nice bodies, and we love those bodies no matter how old they are. Not that I'm being personal or anything. for a guy his age, and we don't know what that is, do we? He's got a very nice body. You should see the knees. Nice knees. I'll stop.
We'll take your word for it.
Yeah. You guys. Now that is a man-to-man joke, isn't it? So there it is. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice of cedars. Isn't that nice? She compares him to something from her home, those beautiful tall trees from her home. His mouth is sweetness itself. He is altogether lovely. This is my lover. This, my friends, O daughter of Jerusalem. You see how she's changed from, oh, do I have to take off my robe? Do I have to, you know, put off the... It's like she's totally changed her attitude now because they've got her to reflect. What is it about this guy that I love? Why did I choose him? And often in our marriages, we've lost that. Why did I choose him in the first place? You know, we get so caught in the details of what he does wrong that we lose the appreciation for who he is and his character. So they really helped her with that. So they say, okay, so her attitude has changed. So now let's help her. And they ask, where has your lover gone, most beautiful of women? Which way did your lover turn that we may look for him with you? So they ask a second question. And this question, it motivates her to say, yeah, okay, now that my heart is right towards him, now I want to take the initiative. to make things right. So it's a very clever question. Once the attitude is right, now she can begin to take the initiative and take action to make things right with him. And it's wonderful because she knows exactly where he is. She says, "My lover has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to browse in the gardens and to gather lilies." Now we wonder, what is that about? We do know from Ecclesiastes 2, verse 5, that Solomon loved horticulture. So he had orchards, he had vineyards, you know, he loved nature and cultivating nature. So we know this. So, you know, it could be that. It could be that he's talking about his work, that he's gone back to his work. He's given her space. But we also know from today, what did she call herself? She said, "Let my lover come into his garden." So what I think what she's saying is, you know, I know his heart is for me. He's waiting for me. It's going to be all good. I can do this. I can approach him because I know at his heart of hearts, I am still his garden and I can go to him. And that's reflected in verse 3. "I am my lover's." There's an amazing confidence. Before she said, "My lover is mine and I am his." But now it's like she can say, "I know I belong to him. I know that we can push through." And that's one of the values as you younger couples work through conflict. It like gives you the confidence with the next conflict to say, "Hey, we can work through this. I know I can get through this." And it's one of the values of facing a conflict and working through it is that you have a new confidence to look forward to the future.
Okay. Let me begin this last part of session three, the third part of the third section, with another Billy Graham or Ruth Graham Bell story. True story, so I've been told. When she was approached by an interviewer once about what really goes on in the Graham household behind closed doors, what is Billy really like? Does he also stand up at mealtimes and preach and altar calls? Yeah. Invitation before dessert and you don't get your cup of coffee until 17 choruses of "Just as I Am." What goes on? And she gave a very candid picture that he's a man with feet of clay, and they had their arguments. And as I mentioned, the concept of hanging clothes up on hangers and putting socks and underwear in the proper drawer never occurred to him. And she's a very neat person, a little bit of OC, obsessive compulsive. So it really turns me off. I get so angry with him. So the interviewer said, "Well, have you ever considered divorce? Has that ever crossed your mind?" And she said, "Divorce? Never. Murder once in a while." That's crossed my mind. But I heard that story long ago, and we've made an agreement, and I commend that for 12 months or 14 months or many, many years, Hambleys and others, many, many years. You guys are cruising on about 7 or 8?
We're just approaching the danger zone.
Oh.
Seven.
Yeah. 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 Okay. But we agreed early on, we would never say the word divorce. Never use the word, spell it out, never even use it in conversation. It was simply not an option. Again, I return to this because it's an experience among us here that sex before marriage is a serious enemy of a marriage that has staying power. Because one thing you see, and you guys are very candid about this, hey? Now, you've got a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old that can grow up now in 10 years, 15 years from now, where they say to a young man, it's a boy and a girl, right? Where they say to a young man or a young woman, "No, you can trust me to wait." And then if a guy has demonstrated, your son, that he can wait until marriage, then when he's off to a sales conference in Los Angeles somewhere for a week, or he's off candidating for a call somewhere in Nairobi, Kenya, for 2 weeks, then instead of wondering, well, what's he up to? Late night meetings, very attractive girls in LA, California girls, all blonde, all lissom, all slender. Now, what's going on? See, he couldn't control himself before marriage. Can he control himself now? But if he said it's not hard, and for us it's not easy, that it is not easy, and there's a lot of will and a lot of won't involved. But if you show your partner that, hey, with God helping, I can wait until the wedding day when the time is right, it's money in the bank for the next 50 years. It was hard for him, but he waited until the wedding night. Now I can trust him when he goes away for a week or two. Or if I'm seriously ill, or I have a serious accident in which I'm paralyzed from the neck down. What does love mean then? Menopause. There's all kinds of situations in which sex is not possible or advisable. And in courtship, you win or lose the battle to gain trust for the next 50 years. So divorce is a lot easier among those who have chosen not to wait. Believe me. In fact, we run across couples all the time who have trouble celebrating their anniversaries. Why? Because they know the anniversary is not really the anniversary. The anniversary of the public and personal and private that Genesis advises, public of leaving, personal in cleaving, private in weaving, in that order, those who have chosen not to honor that divorce much more easily and more often. So, again, wait, money in the bank. You're beautiful, here's the next section. You're beautiful, my darling, as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, 6:4, majestic as troops with banners. Turn your eyes from me, they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep coming up from the washing. Each has its twin, not one of them is alone. Your temples behind your veil are like halves of a pomegranate. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, 6:8. That gives us a lot of trouble, and there are explanations for it. Not complete explanations, but there are explanations. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number. We focus on that as a major problem. I see it as a problem. It's a minor problem. His focus, 6 and 8 is an afterthought, a parenthesis, if you like. But he zeroes in on 6:9. 60, 80, hey, but my dove. And again, there's a sevenfold focus on her specifically. Sevenfold affirmation. But my dove, my perfect one, is unique, the only daughter of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her, the maidens who saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines praised her. And then, after saying that, the daughters of Jerusalem say, who is this that appears like the dawn? 1, fair as the moon, 2, bright as the sun, 3, majestic as stars in procession, verse 6:10. Who is this fourfold dawn, moon, sun, majestic as the stars, increasing spheres of light? And she says, well, I went down to the grove of nut trees to look at the new growth, to see if the vines had budded or the pomegranates were in bloom, to see if this relationship was able to have a new springtime, a new start. We could start again and have that fresh energy for the next leg of our relationship. Before I realized that it happened so quickly, my desire for reconciliation set me among the royal chariots, Solomon's chariots, there's no king in Lebanon, of my people. And for the first time, she speaks about Solomon's people as my people, and then the daughters of Jerusalem respond for the first time by giving her a name. So before I realized that my desire set me among Solomon's royal chariots, of Solomon's royal, and now my people, she adopts his people as well, not just Solomon, but his kingdom. Come back, O Shulamite. That's the female counterpart to Shulamo. That's Solomon. Shulamo is the he. Shulamite is the she. For the first time, they give her that name, and they said, hey, she's adopted not only the king, but the kingdom. And she stepped into a new role. And 4 times, you see, that's why 10 and 13, again, are wonderful bookends. Come back, come back, come back, come back, that we may gaze on you. And then the tail end of 6 and beginning of 7 say, nope. We understand your motivation. We know what you're after. But now that we're combined, we're one again, we're heading for the palace, and we're going straight past the kitchen and the sitting room into the bedroom. And in 7, 1 to 10 is the best sex in world literature. as we're going to say later, because they've had five and six as peacemaking. Now they can be involved in 7 and 8 in lovemaking. Because Solomon is committed in 5 and 6 to having a life partner so that he can have in 7 and 8 a sex partner. And the order is critically important. Peacemaking precedes lovemaking, and a life partner precedes a sex partner. Love is never achieved in sex. It's always expressed in sex. Okay? Now let's back up a little bit, and I'm going to have you help me here. He has not heard the speech that she gave about him. There's no evidence that she said it to the daughters of Jerusalem. He was not around to hear it, so he could say, well, she said very nice things about me. I suppose I can come up with one or two about her. I can reply in kind. One good turn deserves another, we say. As far as we know, he's not heard her speech. He says on his own initiative, you're beautiful, my darling, as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem. Tirzah was for about 60 years the capital of Samaria. Only limits the time that helps us to date the book, by the way. 67 years was the capital. On a hillside, flowing gardens like Babylon, over into the nearest hillside, beautiful city. And Jerusalem was the capital of the south. He's saying, now, you are the Ottawa in my life. You're the capital. You're number one in my life. You're my capital city. And worthy of a defense, majestic as troops with banners, worthy of defending and protecting. And then, turn your eyes from me, and what happens in the next three verses, and this is where I'm going to put you to work, is he'll seem to repeat the honeymoon speech, which is the same, and yet it's not the same. And your assignment is, I'll put it all up here, is to say, well, what is the same in the honeymoon speech, and here we think about a year or more into the marriage, what is the same in the two passages, and why? And what is different? More specifically, what is omitted in 6 that he said in 4? And what does that mean? What does he repeat, and so what? What does he omit, and so what? So work with perhaps one partner and come up with these things. I'll make it a little easier for you. What I've picked up is 4 things that are repeated, and a really good reason why, and 4 things that are omitted, and a really good reason why. But poke around in these two passages and see what you find.